Welcome to Revealing Men, conversations that pull back the curtain, revealing the inner lives of men. I'm Randy Flood, psychotherapist and director of the Men's Resource Center of West Michigan. I'd like to welcome today local therapist Joe Coley and a good friend of mine and colleague from many years. We both worked together in a corporate psychological practice, shall we say, it was close to a decade maybe together we were there or somewhere in there. And then we both kind of went off into private practice around 2000. And Joe specializes in working with, particularly with children with attachment problems and trauma, does a lot of parenting work and education with parents and children. And also as a father, and he'll talk a little bit about his experience as a father. But we're going to talk about fathering in the 21st century and kind of some of the challenges that men are experiencing trying to evolve and transcend some of what was good about the old school fathering, but trying to incorporate some other dimensions. So welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Randy. Great to be here.
Yeah. So I was going to start out by reading this meditation that I ran across a few weeks back, and I think I sent it to you, and you read it as well, and you thought, yeah, that seemed like a good place to start. In a time when mothers, the sacred feminine, the female energy, are being honored, it is important not to forget the importance of fathers. Father energy and mother energy are two complementary energies necessary to bring a healthy human being to fruition in this world. Many of the ideas surrounding fathers are changed in the wakes of more modern parenting styles and the more egalitarian roles that are evolving between the sexes. More men are embodying the mother energy these days, and a woman can provide father energy for her children. So what I'm wondering about, if you could just start by speaking to what you would see as mother energy versus father energy.
Sure. But first, I do have to speak a little bit about myself because one thing I just do want to emphasize is I do not consider myself an expert in parenting or in fathering. I can say I have a lot of experience. Mm-hmm. I've been parenting and fathering for 30 plus years with kids in the house between a set of step-parenting kids and also a set of adoptive kids who do come with special needs. So it's been a lot there. And, you know, I must admit, I do feel I am nervous. I've never done a podcast before, and it has been even a while since I have done some public speaking. I mean, I used to do more presentations and workshops in the community, but, you know, I'm an older clinician now, Randy, and, you know,
Right. We don't have to get out of our seats and travel the earth and market ourselves
as much as we used to.
So you're hunkering down more these days.
I am, particularly this last year, as we all know.
Right.
So I'm taking my pulse, and I'm definitely up a little bit right now. So I'm definitely trying to slow my speech down. One of the things I used to always do in the past when I used to do workshops, I'd had grapes because my mouth is even getting a little dry now talking like this. So I'm going to quick pop one in. And
all right. Mm. Just as long as they're not gummies, are they?
They are not gummies.
Okay. I didn't think so.
Matter of fact, would you like one?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to toss it to you.
Okay.
This is probably has not happened first on a podcast, you know.
Okay. No one actual can see. Grape, they just envision
they can hear it. No, do you want the underhand or the overhand toss? He wants the overhand. So you can do it. Oh, I missed. Okay. But he did get the grape.
Yeah.
Oh. Jeez. Right. Right. Anyways, as we make a mess here.
Yeah.
But right there speaks to, I think, one aspect of masculine energy in terms of parenting is the balance between our authority and playfulness. Mm. You know, that is extremely, extremely important because I think us men, we're still trying to figure out how to deal with power in this new culture, trying to balance both our feminine and our masculine energies.
Right.
You know, I very much found myself being drawn toward the feminine energy as I emerged into my 20s as a male because I didn't want to be that dominant male a-hole out there.
Right.
And I didn't have a lot of good mentors either. I mean, I think they were out there. I just wasn't exposed to them.
Right.
So, you know, and the first thing, you know, when you become a step parent is, oh my gosh, you don't have any power.
Right. To start with, right? You got to kind of earn it, right?
You got to earn it.
Yeah.
You got to earn it.
Right.
And certainly that was a heck of a challenge because it did send me, I did really well with the oldest and the youngest, but the middle stepchild, my buttons were getting pushed and it sent me to get help and it sent me to get into to therapy. But you know, then as I became more comfortable in my skin with fathering and developing relationships with my stepkids and then becoming an adoptive dad, you know, I certainly had to then step into my authority and step into my power and step into my masculine power of what it means.
Right.
You know, one good image that comes to mind for me is Peter Jackson's trilogy movies, you know, The Lord of the Rings. Do you remember the scene, you've seen them, of course.
I've seen them. Yeah. Yes, I have.
The
I'm
return,
not a big geek about it.
Okay, the return of the king scene when Aragorn comes back and he is crowned and he's on top of that precipice of the city. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And he becomes, and then he's walking through the crowd and he comes to the hobbits. Do you remember what happens, kind of? So anyways, the hobbits all bow to him and he goes, no. Nobody bows to you. And he goes to his knee and he bows to them and they raise up. And to me, that's just really the powerful of that balance between the power of the king and the servanthoodness of the king.
Right.
I just love that image, you know. So, you know, how do I balance that out? That to me is just when I see that scene, I always just get emotional about it because I think, you know, when I work with kids, particularly who are traumatized, and have a hard start in life because I work with a lot of adoptive families and the kids had challenging starts, neglect, you know, abuse, trauma. Mm-hmm. And when they come to my office, you know, they really, out of their need to really keep themselves safe in the model of how they've experienced life, they got to have control. The father of attachment therapy, John Bowlby, calls it, these kids become compulsively self-reliant.
Okay.
And I love that.
By survival.
Exactly. Right. They can't trust anybody, so they become compulsively self-reliant, which means they try to control every environment they are in, mm-hmm. including my office, when they come to my office.
Right.
So I've kind of developed a little role play when the kids come in. I kind of check out on their imagination, kind of gives me some clues of whether they have that ability or not, depending on how much severity of neglect they may have experienced. And I ask them to, you know, to imagine. I have some pictures with dinosaurs coming out of them, and I ask them to check it out, and what do they see, and do they see the dinosaurs coming out of the picture? And I say, what do you like to imagine? Then I get into, you know, I like to imagine, too. I like to imagine this is a castle. So I talk to them about my office as kind of being a castle in the lobby area, and the door being the drawbridge that goes down over the moat. Mm-hmm. And I said, if this is a castle, what does that make me, you know? And they're like, yeah, and there's always a hesitation. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, I had one little five-year-old boy. He looked at me and he said, "You're not the king." I said, "What? I'm the king." And he meant it. Yeah. And he controlled everything in his life. And when he didn't, he raged out.
Right.
But that's that control need. Right. But I understand that. But what I really do is, and you know, when we learned, you know, to be therapists, we were always taught about unconditional acceptance, you know, and, you know, and really meet people with where they're at. And I really had to change that. And I've had to step into, you know, the strength of my masculinity, of really showing the kids and the families that I am a strong enough male to be trusted. I don't expect them to trust me. I do not. Yeah. But that this is a safe place, and this is how I create this to be a safe place.
Right. So it would be good to talk about the history of fathering a little bit. Not that we're great historians, but you were talking about this king archetypal energy.
Right.
So
exactly.
Could we talk about this, the old school fathering,
and
what Jungian calls a shadow side of any archetype? So the king side, shadow side is the tyrant.
Yes.
And so he is to be served. And so you think of the old, you know, sitcom, dad comes home all day from a hard day's work, comes yep. in, the slippers come out, the scotch, you know, is served, and the kids are quiet and clean, and
exactly.
house is clean. And exactly. so there was this kind of king energy, but had this taint of dad's here.
Yep.
Dad's had a hard day and hard life, and the kids yep. are to... So say a little bit about that and where we're headed and the balancing of all that out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, luckily, I didn't experience that with my father, mm-hmm. but I certainly understand that, and perhaps from his father or father generations back, the old, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child mm-hmm. kind of attitude, you know, and children are to be seen, not to be heard, you know. And I think, thank goodness, we've kind of swung from that end of the pendulum to the other side of the pendulum now, where we really try to, you know, do the opposite. But you're right, that archetype was very, very dark in the sense of really kind of not allowing children and boys in particular to, you know, to feel safe or to express themselves at all. And they learned the boys' code to shut down really quick, particularly if they had a tyrannical father.
Right. So there's that overemphasis, perhaps. And again, father's got put into this role. I mean, I remember growing up, wait till your father gets home.
Yes.
You know, it's like he's worked all day and he comes home and now he's got to discipline the kids type of thing.
That's
you know,
right.
It's like, so they get kind of categorized as being this person that my job is to, you know, provide the, you know, roof over the head, food on the table, and clothes. But there wasn't this huge notion of mother energy or nurturing or care or connection or affection. So there was this needed energy
yes.
for rules and control and, you know, order, but it was maybe an overemphasis that dads
right.
got put into that role.
Exactly. And yeah. They, I think, were often entrapped by that role. They didn't know other archetypes. Although I would say the worker archetype really became a way for the males to continue to become the provider and the giver, but not wanting to step into that tyrannical role,
mm-hmm.
you know, the unhealthy aspect of that fatherhood.
Right.
I mean, when I look at my dad, I think about him as that worker archetype of really being there. And he worked so hard to provide opportunities for his children that right. he may not have gotten growing up.
Right. And so today, again, you said the pendulum swings. And so I like to study those pendulum swings because my experience, when you look at it, we always, as humans, overcorrect.
Yep.
For a period of time, we swing way over. And so now we have, I think, a child-centric culture.
Correct.
In some ways, where children, you know, get to eat what they want, they get to watch what they want. It's like if dad's watching TV and the kid wants to watch cartoons, dad gets the boot, yeah. you know. I mean, so it's really, in some households, has swung. And do you see, I mean, you work with children where they need a lot of containment.
Correct.
But I'm wondering if you have experience where you think children need to be dethroned, maybe.
Yeah, well, I think that speaks to like what Bowlby was saying. I think when kids are put on the throne perhaps too soon, mm-hmm. then that only, you know, and particularly if they have a harder background, you know, come from a hard place, they of course are going to grab that power and they're going to want to control it and have it and keep it. I remember one time after I got my three adoptive kids and I don't know, they were maybe 6, 5, or 4 and I took him to Burger King and it had one of those play areas, you know, with all the balls and the tubes sure. to crawl through.
Very hygienic.
Yes. Well, anyways, a couple of my kids were getting into it and were getting out of control. And I'm kind of like, darn, you know, if they were out on the space, I know what I would do with them. So I'm kind of like, okay, you need to leave, get out right now and come over by me. Mm-hmm. And they refused because they were scared. They were terrified because, you know, that's part of their background. They're
right.
always afraid. And so this big body, and you know my size,
right.
I crawled in there. You know, trying to hopefully not get stuck in these
balls and tubes.
And anyways, but I got them out. And I sat there, and I do strong sitting with them because I'm a big believer before I engage in them cognitively and kind of from the heart, we just need to settle them. So, you know, but I use my authority. And we're going to sit and we're going to do strong sitting, which we call crisscross applesauce on the floor with hookups, you know, where you take your hands and bend them in. And and it's really, it's good for brain activity and good to help the brain get shifting. So they settled down and then I looked at them and I said, okay, what happened? And they each had their story on, and they know they're supposed to not just blame the other, but to say, well, I pulled her hair, or I slugged him, which both happened. So I'm kind of like, okay, good job for telling the truth. So I really affirm them for being truth tellers, because they need that safe place to talk about the mistakes that they made. But then the consequence was, the punishment was, they had to stay out longer before they got to re-enter. But was amazing, there was an older couple there that was, well, it was grandparents there with their son. And the grandparents witnessed me doing this. And they came on over and they were like, oh my gosh, can you teach our son and daughter-in-law how to do that? Yeah, because they were just like, because, you know, and they said, we just see them never setting boundaries with the kids. And we've, you know, and we don't want to be that tyrannical parent, a tyrannical masculine father model. But we also want that balance between, you know, teaching the kids, you know, the safety to be able to say, this is what I did wrong, and then to help settle them and then help them accept, you know, responsibility. And it was just the hunger of those parents, you know.
So they're that generation is looking at their kids and saying, you know, I see the kids not having that kind of self-control, not being taught or modeled, and they're just running wild. And
Not enough boundaries.
And there's just different ways of teaching that to kids. The old way is, you know, is induce fear of physical pain as a way of deterring them from doing certain things. But I think the more 21st century is seeing these episodes as opportunities for lessons to be taught, or for them to ultimately internalize the lessons, so they see that it's a better way to live more respectfully, or to live, you know, with some more order. I remember my daughter had this stage where, when she started walking around with her snacks, she just liked to throw stuff on the floor. And she knew where the garbage was.
That's right.
And so there was this, you know, put your stuff in the garbage. Lots of talking, didn't work. Pointing the finger, put it in the garbage, you know, didn't work. And I'm like, Randy, you got to be smarter than her. And so she was like obsessive about keeping her room clean, unlike her brother, and liked everything tidy and orderly.
Yeah.
So I came up with this idea. Every time I found a granola wrapper on the floor, I would take it and put it on her pillow. And it drove her crazy, because then she'd have to go take it there, and, you know, and then she wouldn't even throw it down on the floor in her room, but then it'd have to put it in the garbage. And so then she thought, you know, I think it's easier if I just put it in the garbage.
Yes. Smart parenting.
You know, it's like outsmarting them and then helping them understand, you know, why we have that rule.
Right.
And getting them ultimately to internalize that.
Yes.
Is what we're trying to do.
Exactly. Because, you know, what you just mentioned was, you used that strategy, which most of us do, you know, the pointing and, you know, you know, why did you do that? When I used to, earlier in my career, and I was doing workshops, I often got the opportunity to speak to teachers and school professionals.
Right.
And I would often ask them, okay, how many of you have been trained in positive behavioral reward systems? And, you know, and they would all raise their hands, and what's the value of that? And they would speak to that eloquently. They just really found it a very valuable tool. And then I said, okay, and how many of you also use, as part of a discipline strategy, reprimanding your students? And they all raise their hands. And then I say, okay, how many of you had professional training on how to do a reprimand? And you kind of, hardly any hands came up. Because what's a reprimand? Just a fancy word for scolding. You know, pointing your finger and stop doing that.
Right?
And then I asked them, so where'd you learn reprimanding? Where did you learn it from? Our parents.
Right.
That's where we get it.
That's the school.
That's the school.
We go outside the home to learn how to drive and to so many things. But I have found in my life, one of the hardest jobs I've ever done with virtually little training is parenting.
Parenting. Exactly. And I don't know, why can't we break that cycle to really systematically begin teaching more, you know, flexible, dynamical parenting, you know, you know, situations, trainings, helping parents practice, kind of like you did with your daughter.
Right.
You went from, you know, the scolding and you came up with a creative solution.
Right.
That's flexible. That's what we need.
Yeah.
Because too often we all get stuck in scolding. Matter of fact, I remember one time I had a man in my office, a dad, and I make him practice therapeutic scolding. You know, how do you actually effectively scold? Because it can be a really effective tool. But unfortunately, one of the things that makes it non-effective for most parents and for children is the parents go on too long.
It's overused.
It's overused, and they go on.
It's a filibuster.
Yeah, exactly. On and on and on. And that's a complaint you hear from kids, you know. And so
kids' eyes roll back in their heads.
Right. And, they're detached, unattuned, and nothing happens.
Right.
So, but I teach the kid how to take a scolding, and I give them the outline, and we talk about it, and I teach the parent how to give the scolding. And this dad did it, and he was really mad about something the kid had done. He had really done a very, very mean, kind of violent behavior towards another sibling. And so, in the office, he started to do it, and I give him a cutoff sign because he can go no more than 30 seconds with his anger, frustration about it, right? So I could see him. He's looking at me, and I'm like, nope, cut it off. And he's got a switch, right?
Yeah.
So he's got to take some deep breaths, and then he comes down to the child's level with a chair and moves in closer and lowers the voice. It's all part of the training how to practice doing a therapeutic scolding. And all of a sudden, you know, it was really amazing because all of a sudden he started getting tears in his eyes. And then he started to say, oh, I hate being so mad at you. And, you know, and I grew up where I had to be the perfect kid. I could never act out. I could never.
Because what happened to him?
Well, he was terrified. You know,
spanked or you don't know.
You know, he didn't go into that too much. I kind of did learn some of that story later, but it was just the piece that he felt he had to be the perfect kid and he could, you know, and then he was, you know, doing the same thing with this kid who isn't perfect, who's acting out a lot
because
of their fear.
Yeah.
So he got tearful and then it was just this, and you could just see the kid's eyes all of a sudden.
The connection.
The connection.
Yeah.
Exactly. Softening. The kid's shoulders softened, the face softened, and the kid was connecting with the dad. And I think that is really what is so needed now in terms of that balance.
Yeah.
You know, it is okay for us to be mad and angry and frustrated with our kids and to express those feelings, but they also need us to modulate those feelings.
Right.
They need us to demonstrate emotional regulation so that we shift out of that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But we're not very good at doing that. We're not trained how to do it. Because what we often do, we can't stay angry. Nobody can stay angry. Well, but
some people can rage.
But most people, you know, you start to soften with your kid and you're like, you know, and wouldn't it be so much easier if you had just done this way in the beginning, we wouldn't be into all this conflict. But every time you know, that's what we do. We start to come down and we spike back up,
right?
You know, and we keep spiking. And what happens is the kids don't see us calming down. They only see the spikes.
Yeah.
So they only see us angry.
Right. And I think when you have that attachment and that connection, when you change your voice and they hear your disappointment in them.
Yes.
That my granddaughter's 2.5 and she's just experiencing her ability to be aggressive and that she can hit. And so she's like, just impulsively sometimes will just like hit me and I'll grab her hand and just kind of hold it tightly and speak very firmly. You may not hit Papa. And look her right in the eyes.
Yeah.
And she just starts weeping.
Right.
I want hugs. You know, and then we do nice hands. And then I say, if you want to hit something, I show her the pillow and I smack the pillow. You can hit the pillow or whatever, but you can't hit Papa. And just, it's a sweet moment when she realizes that, you know, this is not acceptable. And right. she doesn't want to really hurt Baba.
Right. Yeah. But she was attuned to your authority
yeah.
and to your boundary.
Yep.
And then she also was attuned knowing you were going to get to right. that sweet part.
Right.
And connection. Yeah. That's yeah. the piece, that whole piece. Right. It can't be just, you know, we scold a kid and then walk away.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we have to modulate right. ourselves and come down and connect. And so many parents tell me, and dads tell me, well, particularly dads tell me, I don't know what to say to the kid. And I'm like, that's okay. Tell your kid that.
Start there.
Yeah, you don't know what to say. And what I tell the fathers in particular is what's more important is your nonverbals, because they see you, and unconsciously they see you going from being angry and upset to sad and disappointed. Mm-hmm. But now they see that shift in a calmer way, in a non-threatening way.
Right.
That speaks more than right. any perfect words you can say or any right. lessons you can give in that moment.
Yeah. So just want to see if you have a position or an opinion, or based on your clinical experience, your fathering experience, or what you've read about people who are listening today and saying what kids really need is more discipline, because we live in this child-centric world and where, you know, they're running wild and don't have any discipline. What about the person who says spankings are what we need to do and that's what kids need? Is what would you say to that in terms of what you know about that and how it can work, but...
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, certainly professionally, if I am working with kids that have any history of trauma, I do not endorse corporal punishment because in my book, it contributes to a strong likelihood for a re-traumatization of the child. Mm-hmm. And it's just not effective. You may end up getting a kid to behave, but they're only behaving because they're terrified.
Mm-hmm.
It's all fear-based. And it's not behaving because, you know, they want to please you, because they want to connect with you.
Mm-hmm. So, what about the internalization lesson? If it's, oh, if it doesn't, yeah. it internalizes
yeah.
much or?
Yeah. Oh, it internalizes. Particularly with kids that are already traumatized, they already have the internalizations. I'm a bad kid. I'm yeah. not worthy. I wasn't good enough to be kept by my birth parents or whatever.
Right.
And then, you know, you throw in that type of discipline, and it just reinforces that. As a matter of fact, it kind of like it's all their yuck, and now their parents are angry at them. They just, see, they really don't like me. They don't love me.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably going to get rid of me sooner or later. And that is not an uncommon internalization for kids. But even, I think, in families without kids that come from traumatized backgrounds, you know, it is the right for parents to use corporal punishment, but I don't find it necessarily overall that effective. You got to have the whole tools. You got to have the effective scolding. You got to have the creative solutions like you mm-hmm. came up with your daughter.
Right.
There's just so many ways. But yeah. to me, it's all about whatever that contact set is from an attachment perspective, is that there's a misattunement, the kid acts out,
right?
You know, and then there needs to become a reattunement. You know, and I think that's the value of the... you know, the feminine parenting side of things was, right. you know, focusing always on connection and repair, you know,
yeah.
so that's yeah. that's a beauty. And I grew up with that. And my wife really taught me in terms of step parenting that I needed to focus on the repair side of things.
Right.
And because I didn't have the authority as a parent, as a stepdad.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
yeah. And I think, you know, it's not, I wouldn't say just exclusively mothering energy, but this, to me, what I always found helpful is to ask the question is, why is my child acting out? Because if you can answer that question, you often can solve the problem, you know, because there can be so many reasons why they're acting out. They're just little humans that can't make sense of the world, and they have these right. strong emotions, and they have these, you know, they're sleep deprived, or they're hungry, or they're exploring their power, or whatever it might be. I remember when my daughter realized she could get out of her crib and she was walking. We didn't have a day bed for her yet. She she's not going to bed because she can scale her crib and she'd walk out in the living room. Like, I'm not going to bed. And I'm like, Anna, it's bedtime. Pick her up, carry her, put her back to bed. Guess how many times I did that? 36 the first night.
Only 30.
36 the first night. Second night, it was like down in the teens. And then, you know, by three or four nights, she was trained. She knew that it wasn't going to work. Now, I could have beat her ass the first night, you know, and maybe would have been successful, you know, and I look at the toolbox of parenting, right? It's, I could use the 2-pound hammer the first night, or I could, you know, get out the Allen wrenches and kind of do some different things and tweaks. And ultimately she learned that, you know, dad's got authority and he decides when I go to bed, not me. And it did it in a nonviolent way. But that's a joke that we kind of still, she's a willful person and a human being still. Yes. but it was just her testing her power.
Yeah. And
that's what children do.
Yeah. 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 So, there always are underlying dynamics. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's great when we can get to the whys. But I think parents also need to be prepared that they may not know the why.
Yeah.
And we got to just help them get through the moment and in nonviolent ways, but in strong ways.
Right.
You know, do the parenting.
Right. Yeah.
Do the fathering. Yeah.
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 So just as we kind of start winding down, you're a Trekkie. And so I remember talking to you about a model of fathering that you thought was exhibited in one of the characters.
Yeah. So probably one of the most least liked Star Trek series is Deep Space Nine. And that was when I was doing the step-parenting, was in the 90s when Deep Space Nine came out. I thought it was one of my favorites because, you know, it wasn't a typical Gene Roddenberry spaceship traveling to, you know, all kinds of distant galaxies and worlds. This was a space station that was there. And one of the main characters was Captain Benjamin Sisko, who was played by Avery Brooks. And I just really fell in love with him as both the captain and how he had to make all the tough decisions. Mm-hmm. It was just a great, and he also had this incredible gentle side of him, particularly as a single parent with his son Jake on board. And it was just a beautiful, and then again, he was an African-American doing this. And you think back then and the, you know, the role modeling, it was just a fantastic. Matter of fact, I saw a documentary a while back on it, and a little kid asked Avery Brooks as Captain Benjamin Sisko, what was your favorite mission on Deep Space Nine? And he said, raising Jake.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was, if you go back and look at that series, besides dealing with all the really political, cultural issues that they dealt with, they also presented him, I thought, as an excellent father archetype.
And what a great way to send a message to 21st century fathers that, you know, it's like, we have lots of missions in life, you know, whether you're going to be a trial lawyer or you're going to, you know, be a scientist and what have you. But, you know, what a great mission to embrace is being a dad and, you know, the beauty and challenge of that. And and the openness that I think 21st century dads have today, I think of my relationship with my son and being able to be more affectionate, because the old school fathering was, you know, you get off my lap and, you know, and go bruise up your knees a little bit. You don't need to be, you know, pampered with me, but just to be able to have that affection, and it continues today. He's 32 and I can still give him a big old kiss and hug, you know, and it's just the freedom that comes with being able to embrace the nurturing side.
Exactly.
You know, not just the, you know, the discipline side of parenting.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So. And, you know, to embrace our failures, what we did well and what we didn't. And, you know, unfortunately I failed getting the grape into your mouth at the beginning of this podcast. But I still hope it was valuable and it went well. And, you know, I had my, had some of my kids around my dinner table for Father's Day last Sunday, and I kind of asked them, what did I do well and what did I didn't do well?
What a great question.
And certainly one of the things they said I didn't do well was when I got angry with them, I got too close to them, you know, and I invaded their space at times. And I'm like, I could see myself doing that. Mm-hmm. But then I also got a text from one of my other kids, and he said, I can't remember exactly how it went, but he said, good sir, even though, you know, you have parented six kids and none of your own loin, which is true, he said, I am very glad that I was one of the ones to be fathered by you.
Nice.
And that, you know, I know that you loved us and were committed to us.
Yeah.
You know, so that was just a sweet text.
The best gift you could ever have on Father's Day, huh? Yeah. Those sentiments.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming today, Joe, and talking with us about fathering from your personal experience and clinical experience and just your general wisdom as a human being.
You are welcome. And to all fathers out there, you know, step into your authority and non-loving ways and accept your failures and get help.
Yeah.
Right.
Because,
that's
there
so
is help.
Important.
We have nurturing dads programs here at the Men's Resource Center.
There you go.
And so we try to help fathers be the best version of themselves. So thanks, Joel.
You're welcome, Randy.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Revealing Men. If you're looking for more information about counseling, coaching, and consultative services, please visit the Men's Resource Center of West Michigan online at menscenter.org. Also, feel free to contact us on our website if you have questions about this segment, ideas for a topic, or would like to be a guest on the Revealing Men podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating so others can find us. Be well and have a great day.